you doing, everyone? I'm Russ Salzberg, and I want you all to listen up and get a load of this. The Giants are a miserable 1-7 in last place. And everybody, and I mean everybody, has an opinion on what to do about it. So I figured, who better to ask and chat with than an expert? The man who made the deal for Eli Manning to become a Giant. I'm talking about former Big Blue General Manager, Ernie Accorsi. So like I said, listen up, because you're really going to want to get a load of this. All right, so like I said, everybody's got an opinion on your 1-7 Giants, and I really thought there is nobody better to ask about this, especially going into the bye week, than the man who was a former general manager with the Giants. He was the man who brought Eli Manning to the Giants. I'm talking about Mr. Ernie Accorsi, who's been with us before. Ernie, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Russ.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we were talking with a situation that was 7-1 as opposed to 1-7. But as Bill Parcells says, you are what your record says you are. So everybody's got an opinion on this, Ern. And, you know, let me ask you straight up. It's 1-7. I didn't expect this. Listen, you consulted the Giants on bringing Dave Gettleman, who, as far as I'm concerned, was without a doubt the right guy for the job. I still believe that. But having said that, is this 1-7 a shock to your system?
Well, first of all, I don't have any more answers than anybody else because I'm just a fan on my couch. But I didn't expect 1-7. No, I knew that. Look, I've been a part of rebuilding, Russ. And I don't want to get sidetracked on my answer, but I do want to explain one thing. I took over a Baltimore Colt team that was winless the year before in the strike season, 9 games, and we won 7 games in the first year after that. It was a block-by-block rebuilding in a different time, no free agency. But after we went to the Super Bowl in 2000, I sat down with Dave and Jerry, and I said, we're not good enough to win a world championship. We have to rebuild this team. Now, we're coming off a Super Bowl, but I said, we have to rebuild it. I said, we have to rebuild. The offensive line played its heart out, but with Glenn Parker and Lomas Brown and Ziegler, we had a lot of age there. I said, we have a good quarterback. We got to get a great quarterback, and we have no pass rushers. I said, so we have to block by block rebuild this team. And that was 2000. 2002, we made a little run, blew that 34-14 playoff game in the fourth quarter to San Francisco. And in 2003, we fell apart, 4-12.
Right.
Okay, so we started to rebuild the team in 2004 with Eli. Plus, we started picking OC and Tuck. We had Strahan, Kiwanuka, signed Antonio Pierce and Plexico. We rebuilt that team, and it didn't win again. It didn't win until 2007. Although it won the division in 2005, made the playoffs in 2006. The reason I retrace this is you can't do it overnight. I mean, you got to do it methodically. You can't be influenced by panic. And it's going to be step by step. I can't imagine anybody better to do it than Dave. He was part of our rebuild. He didn't rebuild from scratch with Carolina, but they weren't ready to go to the Super Bowl. And in 2 years, they did. You have to rebuild the blocks, and you can't. You need all 22 players plus the two specialists, but you've got to have number one, the quarterback, and number two, the two lines. If you don't have pass rushers, and you can't protect the passer in today's game, which is a passing league, then you're not going to win. So you have to start to rebuild that, and that takes time. So he knows how to do it. But, unfortunately, this isn't college where you can recruit 25 five-star players. You get 7 draft picks. You have to be careful in free agency, and he'll get it done. But the 1-7 record, I mean, except for the Eagles game, they were in every game. So they could have won any one of those games. I'm not saying they're a playoff team, but they could have won any one of those games. So 1-7 records happen when things don't fall your way or you don't get a touchdown or, things don't happen at the end of the game. But, it's going to be a complete rebuild, and sometimes you got to get worse before you get better. So, the record is inconsequential at this point. Are they on the road to rebuilding the team?
Well, let me ask you this, because you brought up the three things, the three factors, the pass rush, offensive line protection, and the passer. The elephant in the room every day, ad nauseum in the newspaper, on the radio, on Twitter, every place, is the quarterback. And you know, obviously Eli is on the back nine. We all know that. Eli knows that. But, you know, and this is not, I'm not the president of the Eli Manning Chamber of Commerce. I just know what he's done and what he's capable of doing. I think he's being unfairly whipped on to the point, I mean, you would think he's a bum who can't do anything. You know, football to me, and you being a GM knows better, or a former GM knows better than anybody. It's got to be the cohesiveness, as you say, of the 22 guys, 11 on offense, 11 on defense. And if he can't be upright and he's on his ass, he can't be the Eli that you want him to be.
Yeah, I know, Russ, but the quarterback's the lightning rod. Now, look, I was with the Baltimore Colts. I got my start with them. In 1968, which is 2 years before I got there, I was at a game against the Cleveland Browns. They went 13-1, lost to the Super Bowl game to the Jets. Marl was having a bad game. He led them to 13 wins. Bad game, so they put Unitas in. He had been hurt preseason. They booed him loudly, okay? 1972, in the beginning of the season, before he was benched, they booed him. So when I was just a puppy, but I realized to myself, I said, if they can boo Johnny Unitas,
oh my goodness,
they can boo anybody.
Yeah,
okay?
You're right.
And you know, Paul Brown, God rest his soul, used to talk before he died. I used to ask him a million historical questions. They were booing Otto Graham. Now, Otto Graham went to 10 championship games, won 7 of them in his career. And, you know, they had a backup named George Raderman. Now, the most popular guy on the team is the backup quarterback, especially if he's a veteran with any credentials. And he used to tell the story that they started a chant in Cleveland, "We want Raderman, we want Raderman." Of course, Paul Brown, being a pretty tough guy, went over to Raderman and said, "They want you, go sit with them." Okay, but the quarterback is always going to be the lightning rod. And it's natural. I mean, that's the way it is. You know, he's the person that people watch, and you know, and I feel, look, I don't have a lot of objectivity with Eli. I mean, Eli's almost like a member of my family.
Yeah, he's your guy. You brought
right.
him.
And I know what he's brought here. I know that he's the only guy in the history of this franchise to win 2 world championships. I love him to death, and I hate to see him go through this. But, you know, I've been around. I was in the league 45 years. I've seen it all, so nothing surprises me. That's just the way it is.
Well, so, okay, that brings me to this question then. Do you think at 1-7, not to insult Eli, just because the Giants, as you say, you know, they got to start doing a block by block. Do they need to know what they have in Kyle Loletta? And do you think Eli needs to take a seat, or do they continue with this, you know, on this avenue?
Russ, I've been retired 11 years. I have never commented on
okay.
what the Giants should do, and I'm not starting now. That they don't need that from me. And you know, when I took over as general manager in '98, George Young never did that, and I learned from George Young. And he would call and said, "You need any advice?" And I always asked, because I called him most of the time, and I took his advice. Believe me. But he never said a word, and I'm never going to say a word. That's not my job. They have enough of people there that have great experience and know the situation better than I do. And, you know, I just root. That's all I do.
Well, fair enough. I mean, me personally, I think Eli needs to play because, and, you know, listen, nobody's ever, you know me from working with you. Nobody's ever accused me of being a Pollyanna. But I look at the situation, and he was sacked 7 times yesterday, okay? I mean, it's 31 times the first half of the season. So to say, I mean, I guess it ruffles my feathers because people talk about him as if he should be discarded like an all-star ram. But, you know, you just brought up a good point before. If Johnny Unitas can get booed,
anybody.
Eli can get booed. Anybody can get booed. I think it gets ugly, and listen, probably nobody is more qualified to talk about this because you were a journalist before you got into this business. You were a newspaper man. You were a newspaper writer. Albeit, Ernie, it was in a different time, okay, and especially now with social media. But I just find now the agenda from certain people, it's such a pile-on on Eli And not just Eli, quite frankly, a pylon on the Giants. People have an agenda every day where it's almost, I feel, they don't want it to get better. And my concern is, you know what that does? Then it gets the natives unhappy and the fans unhappy and they buy into it. And, I believe Dave Gettleman, you and I have discussed this before. The best kind of GMs are the ones who think not with their hearts, even though it's hard sometimes, because if you start thinking with your hearts and thinking, worrying about the heat, you're not going to succeed. Am I correct?
Correct. I mean, you have to, I'm a sports historian, and especially in my retirement years, I don't know what good it's going to do me at this point in my life, but I still take notes and still listen to GMs and still listen to coaches and managers. And I heard Kenny Holland interviewed of the Detroit Red Wings. And they went to the playoffs 20 straight years. I think they won 3 Stanley Cups. And they missed them badly the last 2 years, and it looked like, I think they're 1-8. So they're headed for no playoffs again. He is getting a tremendous amount of heat. That's a rabid hockey town, as you know. It's called Hockey Town USA.
Right.
And I heard him interviewed the other day on the Hockey Channel on XM. I was driving. And he said, I have one thing I tell my staff, steady on the rudder. He said, I trust my scouts. I trust our system. It's worked. Sure, it's got to be tinkered with, adapted to the future, changed, and we have to be progressive, be aware of analytics and statistics, which is the byword of the day. He said, but believe in your principles, circle the wagons, and don't be influenced from outside words. You listen to the people who are in the boat with you, whose careers are on the line, and that's what you have to do. Easier said than done, but that's what you have to do. But, Russ, today, every fan's a reporter.
Yeah.
I mean, you walk down the street. I'm very, very careful now, not as much today, although people still come up to me, but particularly when I was general manager, people would come up and vent their frustrations. I kept my mouth shut and thanked them and kept walking. Because you say one word, it's out there. No matter what you say, you talk to a reporter, it's different. You're on guard. But today, I mean, they all have cameras in their phone, and they have recorders, and they'll write what you say. And once it gets out there, I mean, I've asked reporters, do you guys react to these blogs and to Twitter, which I don't have, and all these things? And they say, we have to, because our editors react to it. I mean, our editors will come to us and say, I just read on Twitter that this and this, you don't have that story. So I've got to follow those stories to see where they lead me. I mean, these reporters are on call 24 hours a day. I was never on call 24 hours a day. We had deadlines from 5:30 to 12:30 as a morning paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer. After that, I could sleep. We weren't coming out. Unless they declared war, there was not going to be no extra. Okay?
Well, no, I can tell you from experience, my own personal experience, I agree with what you say. That I do understand, because I know from being in a TV newsroom, somebody sees something on Twitter, or you're in a radio newsroom, somebody sees something on Twitter. Did you get this? Did you run? I mean, somebody farted. Did you get this? No, really, to the point that it gets crazy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not happy to be old, but I don't know. I'm happy not to be working in this era, because it's tough. I mean, you have to have severe self-discipline, extreme self-discipline, because otherwise, you can be affected by all this. You just have to understand that, I told Joe Thomas, who I thought that was, the one of the great evaluators of all time, and he was my boss in Baltimore at the end, the general manager I worked for at the end, and he's the guy who eventually benched Unitas and traded him, which caused a furor. Now, people were booing Unitas the minute that he benched him, he martyred him.
Yeah, right.
And they turned on him. And I said to him once, he didn't like criticism. So I said to him one time, I said, you got a problem, Joe. You have Harry Truman's guts and Lyndon Johnson's thin skin. That's not a good combination, okay? If you're going to be Harry Truman, you got to have Harry Truman's thick skin. And you better have a thick skin. I didn't like being criticized, but I guess maybe because I was a reporter, and even in a different generation, I had been critical of players and coaches, that I understood that's part of the game. I knew it, and I would try not to, like George said, they don't read the papers. I said, that's impossible. because if I happen not to have read the papers, somebody in that office is going to tell me, did you see what was in the papers?
Right.
So I'm going to know what's in the papers, but you just have to you can't be have a one-track mind. You have to be flexible and open to people's suggestions. And believe me, there are suggestions and things that the media has mentioned or fans have mentioned that I've listened to. And it made sense. I mean, nobody has exclusivity on the right thing to do. And a lot of these fans, you know, and I always understood this. The fans have an emotional stake in this team. I was a fan. I know what it was like to grow up as a Yankee fan, second-guessing Casey Stengel, not bringing Ford in the 1960 World Series. I still haven't gotten over that. Okay, but that's part of being a fan. But I had tears in my eyes when Mazeroski hit the homer. So the point is that I know that fans are invested. Their emotion, it's sincere emotion. Sure, they strike out and are critical. Well, so was I. And I'll tell you, the 1955 World Series, which the Dodgers claim is their only victory while they were in Brooklyn.
Right.
Stengel loved Noren. Mantle got hurt. Instead of playing Bob Serve, he played Noren, who hit in the 6 double plays in 1 7-game series. Still a record. I still remember that, and I was second-guessing Stengel. So I've been through that.
You don't let things go, do
no,
you?
No, I don't let things go, okay? I always said the Dodgers talk about 55. Mantle was hurt. That's the only reason they won. But the fact is that's why I've always been tolerant of that, because I understand it. You know, you can't let everything influence you, but you pay attention and then go back to work.
Yeah, I don't want to get stuck on the media, but it has become so much part of it. You know, my only point is, look, last year when the team was 2-9 and, you know, Ben and Jerry, you know, attempted to bench Eli or at least, you know, have him start and have somebody else come in, and Eli didn't want to go for it. Okay. But at 2-9, there was an uproar and everybody went nuts in favor of poor Eli, in particular people in the media. And quite frankly, I thought it wasn't genuine sincerity, because they were using Eli as an excuse because they didn't like Ben. So that's a way for us to get at Ben. Then 2 games into the season, forget the 1-7, at 0-2, you probably read this stuff because you're a newspaper guy. At 0-2, oh, they made the wrong pick. They shouldn't have gotten Saquon. They needed to get Donald. Eli's had it. And, you know, just be consistent. That's all I say. That's the world that we live in right now. All right, so let me ask you this. I you know, you're not going to make a decision for, you know, when I ask you about should they do this with Eli or that. In your opinion, can Eli still play quarterback?
I told you before. I 11 years I haven't gotten into this.
Okay.
Right? I'm not going to get into it now,
right.
Okay? And I'm too close to Eli. I don't want to get into it.
Fair enough.
That's not my decision.
I respect it. Listen, I want the job for, you know, because you're Ernie Accorsi. But, you know, when I look at the situation, they had 37 yards rushing yesterday, okay? And you're talking to a guy, I mean, you know, I'm doing their shows twice a week. I do their pregame shows. You know, they had 37 yards rushing. They got a stud running back. So that tells me when everybody, you know, it's not just about pass protection. It's about run blocking as well.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have any running room. And basically, the plays he makes, he kind of makes on his own. He's got to bounce it outside. But, you know, if they don't, I can see how they're playing this. I mean, they feel that they're rushing the passer. The passer doesn't have much time to throw. They're not going to beat us in the air, so we're just going to shut down their running game. And if you do that, you become one-dimensional, and that's what they're doing with us. I mean, you have to run the ball. You know, look, Tom Brady doesn't have to run the ball all the time. I mean, I saw him come out one night on a Monday night game where he threw 21 straight passes, I think, on the first 21 plays. But he may be the greatest to ever play the game, and he was protected. So he got, you know, even though he never had great, great receivers except for Randy Moss, who he only had at the end of his career. But for the most part, he's Tom Brady. And they had a team around him. But for the most part, to get anything out of the passing game, you have to have the running game. I mean, Parcells used to always say that. I don't want to quote him incorrectly, but I remember him telling me one time, when you commit to the run, it isn't to try it for a while, that you can go in at halftime with 20 yards and 17 carries, you come out, you run the ball again in the second half, because running the ball is a mentality, and you have to keep trying it, trying it, trying it. But if your offensive line can't dominate the line of scrimmage, then you're not going to be able to run the ball when they don't feel they're going to get burned throwing the ball. So that's what's happening to the offense. So, although the offense is moving, there are you know, yards being compiled. It's just it gets in scoring position and they can't score.
Now, okay, so forget the Giants for a second. Okay, I'm trying to get to a point here, but you know, you have a team that can go up and down the field, and then you know, you get, as we say, you know, get to the red zone, and it all bogs down. Is it just a function of, again, the line play, or is it just a combination? It could be the Giants or anybody else. Is it a combination of, okay, we're getting into this area where we have trouble, and it does it become psychological?
You can't. It's a hard place to score.
Yeah.
Okay, number one. But I think, and this is really a generalization, and the game has changed, because 20 years ago it was probably 60 to 40 runs to pass. Now it's almost 60 to 40 pass to run. But even with that said, that usually, and the red zone is a misnomer. Is it the 30? Is it inside the 20? To me, the red zone's inside the 15, 10-yard line. That's when you have to score. You have to run the ball down there. And if you look at what happens to all teams, they'll run the ball on first down. Now, I don't get anything. So it's second and now they throw it. And you start throwing those fades, which, in a sense, those fade patterns, that's like playing against 13 men. You have the sideline and the back line. Yeah, that the fade pattern has to be a perfect throw and catch for it to work. And everybody seems to try those. Now it's third down. And it's tough to throw down there. It's all jammed up. And you have to, you know, somebody's got to break open or have tremendous protection where you can wait for somebody to break open. That's why it's so hard. But if you can run the ball down there, if you're on the 9-yard line, every yard line, you get 7 yards on first down. Now you got a chance. It's second and goal from the two. But you don't see that happening very often. I mean, it's just, but you know, you see guys like the Rams can run the ball. Gurley gets yardage down there, and you know, Peterson can still run the ball. But there aren't, and their line's good. So when you can get significant yardage on first down down there, you can score. But if you're not, now you're behind the eight ball, and you got to try to make them. You got to try to fit a play in there. It's not easy.
You know what, Ernie? You may. I'm serious when I say this. You really make it sound simple. And football to me, of all the sports, I think football is the most complicated, just because you have the most men on the field at one time, and I think it's the quintessential team sport. If everybody is not working in unison, you know, things can go, you know, bad wrong real fast. You know, baseball's a little different, and you know, in basketball, you know, one guy doesn't win it by himself, but if you have one guy who can dominate, you know, it makes a difference. You know, to me, you have a kid like Saquon. I guess you're answering the question that it all has to work together.
Yeah, I mean, it may sound simple, but it's not easy to run the ball down there.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're jamming you up, and it's hard. I mean, it's you see it. And listen, we wouldn't have 8 million field goals being kicked every week if it was easy to score down there. Now, our red zone is near the bottom of the league, but it's difficult for most teams down there. And if you don't run it, I don't have this broken down in analytics, but to me, most of the passing touchdowns inside the 10-yard line are done on first or second down. Very rarely is it going to be third down or fourth down if you don't elect to kick the field goal. And it's just very, very difficult. But you running the ball, you know, it's still, even though you have a big pass ratio advantage now in percentages, running the ball and stopping the runner, you got to start there before you go any further. And then you go to the pass blocking and stopping the pass and rushing the passer. But if they can run on you, first of all, it disheartens you. It breaks your will. And secondly, it sets everything else up. And it's tough if they're going to do what they're doing, they're jamming our poor Saquon in the backfield before he ever gets any kind of traction.
Yeah, I don't know if you're aware of this, and I know just by you talking to me the way you were listening to the hockey channel on Sirius, but, you know, Saquon, I think he was, well, you know what? Going into this past weekend, Eli was sixth in passing yardage. Saquon was fourth in rushing yardage, and Odell was fourth in receiving yardage. You know what, Ernie? That's happened only seven times in the last decade, and two of them are this season. It was it's the Giants and the Chiefs. So that's not easy to do. But Saquon, going into yesterday, and I'm sure it didn't change. I mean, this is Saquon Barkley. He led the league in most negative yard rushes. So, I mean,
well, yeah, and they mentioned it yesterday that he. He makes a lot of big plays, and a lot of them he bounces outside, but it's not like he's got a steady diet of 5 yards a carry.
Right.
He'll make a run for 35 yards and then have negative yardage, and that's exactly the reason is what they're doing to him. I mean, if he gets a seam and he gets a crack and accelerates with that power, he's on his way. But if he can't get out of the starting blocks, it's impossible for him for that to happen. I mean, he's making plays in the passing game, too. He's flaring out of the backfield and getting a quarterback out of trouble very often. He's compiling yardage as a receiver. But you got to get him out in space, and, you know, we haven't been able to do that.
You being an old publicity guy at Penn State, you must love the fact that he's a Giant.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I was really happy. And I saw him play. I watched them every week. And I just fell in love with the guy, just like everybody else. That not only, not only is a great player, but he's such a great kid. I mean, and I still have some contacts back there, and not many, but some, and they all just underline that he's humble, he's a great kid, great family, and just yesterday there was a little girl that has been ill. She's made a great comeback, and her father took her to the game yesterday, and she's from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and she's a Penn State fan, and she bought a Barkley jersey, and she wanted to go to the field pregame. I got her passes to go on the field pregame from Allison Stansby.
Right, sure.
And she's down there, and her father sent me an email after they went home. She said that she was down there, and I told him, I said, you can't talk to players. So... Barkley comes running by. She's got the Barkley jersey. She's a cute little girl. She's like 13 or 14 years old. And she's waving to him, and he comes all the way over and high-fives her. I mean, you know, that's him. This is pregame when a lot of them, you know, are so concentrating so heavily and really don't look anywhere but straight ahead, have blinders on. Yet he saw her, saw the jersey, saw the cute little girl, came over and high-fives her.
You know,
it made her day. Might have made her year.
I'll tell you something. I made this comment here before, and I've made it other places on the air, and I'm sincere about it. I've been in this town for 30 years, you know, and I've seen them all, including Derek Jeter, who, as they say in my hood, is a mensch. And I will tell you this. I have never seen anybody, any rookie come into this city, into this town, this area, and that includes Jeter. And you got guys like Aaron Judge who are just tremendous people. Nobody is better than Saquon. I mean, he's polished off the field to a point. He's wise beyond his years. He just, I guess his parents must have done a bang-up job because he really handles himself extremely well.
He's a great kid. I saw one of his first touchdowns when a bunch of players started to come over to surround him and celebrate. He just brushed them off. You know, I mean, I'm not saying he won't eventually, but it's in his mind, like, I just got here. I'm not going to start celebrating now, and we're behind. And he just ran off to the bench. He's a special kid. I just hope he gets to enjoy winning here like he did at Penn State. It's got to be tough when, you know, you play someplace and maybe lose four games and, well, he played 3 years, if that, and have to go through this. Here, it's awful tough. There's no question about
it. So let me ask you this. You know, he is 1-7 now. You know what the old saying is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Is that how it has to be looked at, both from a player standpoint and the coaching standpoint, that this is just going to make you stronger? But, you know, from a coaching standpoint, you know, you got to be psychologist as well to make sure, you know, that you have the pulse of the team. Now, by me saying that, I firmly believe Pat Shurmur has the pulse of the team. I don't see any quitting these guys. I don't see any negativity. I mean, are they pissed off? Well, who wouldn't be pissed off at 1-7?
Yeah. First of all, the last thing in the world I would worry about is any psychological problem with Saquon as far as losing. That his character's off the charts. I worry about physically. That I always worry about with any running back because they take a beating. But I don't worry about anything else. He's not going to lose his edge. He is what he is. His character has already been established. That template's set. And he's going to be a leader on this team. I just hope he stays healthy. That's the only thing I hope for him.
So you're the general manager of any team. Okay, your record's 1-7. You're in the bye week. Is it good for the guys to get away to, like, okay, reflect a bit or just clear the cobwebs and come back? Or, you know, some people say, hey, we just want to stay at it and keep on playing. I don't know if there's a right or a wrong. You know, I asked Odell yesterday in postgame and, you know, just asked him. He said, yeah, maybe it's good just for everybody to take a break, think about it, and then come back strong and, you know, try to win some games.
I don't have the pulse of this team. I don't know. Usually it's when things aren't going, you know, when things are going well, you don't want to stop.
Right.
Usually when things are not going well, it's usually good to take some time off, yeah. But he has to understand that. He's got a very young team. He's got to figure that out. I'm sure he's going to give him some time off. But how much and what he does, I don't. He's got to understand his own team. I don't understand it. I'm not around them. I don't know these kids at all.
You mentioned it before, Ernie. I mean, listen, you got a pretty well-storied career, you know, from, you know, the Colts to the Browns. You had success. I mean, pretty adept at drafting quarterbacks. You got Bernie Kosar in the supplemental draft for the Browns in 85. I mean, you helped you go to 3 AFC championship games, and you made the deal for certainly Eli Manning, and, you know, two Super Bowl championships later, here the Giants are, albeit right now they're not in a situation they want to be at. You know, everybody talks about the draft. How difficult is it? Because, you know, Jerry Reese is getting beat up pretty good, but people forget, you know, Jerry was part of a pretty good staff under you, and, you know, they did win two Super Bowls under Jerry Reese.
The draft, well, first of all, when we made the trade for Eli, we ended up with four draft picks. I got hammered. You know, I remember standing in the back of an elevator where fans were getting on in the old stadium, but when they moved the press box upstairs,
right,
we were on the same elevator as people who were in the suites. They didn't see me. I'm in the back, and I'm getting killed. It was after a night game. You know, now we only have four picks. We don't have a number one next year. Okay, the next draft we get Corey Webster, Justin Tuck, Brandon Jacobs. Now, our fourth pick was a defensive pass rusher from Florida State, who, and this spoken like a true general manager, should have made the team. We should have been 4-for-4. He got cut. I don't remember what happened to him. But without those three guys, we don't win the two Super Bowls. I don't care who we have at quarterback. Those were three crucial guys. Great pass rusher, a great corner who makes the interception in the championship game, and Brandon Jacobs, who was an incredible big back, okay, who complimented Bradshaw. So the fact is that you just make your draft choices count. I mean, you don't have to pick Hall of Famers in the fourth, fifth, sixth round, but you got to pick contributing players who help win championships. And the draft is your lifeblood. That's your lifeblood. Now, we took that team and we drafted well. We had drafted OC right before that, but we had two huge free agent signings: Antonio Pierce, who ran the defense, and Plaxico Burress, who we don't win without him. So those were two right there. We had others, but those two guys. So we didn't go wholesale in the free agency market. And but we still lived and died with the draft, and that's how you can get it back. I mean, you know, I saw Joe Thomas build. We were 2-12. It was 14 games. We had two drafts. He built in two drafts. He got Roger Carr, Burt Jones, traded for George Koontz, who's a great left tackle, and built the sack pack. It's 156 sacks in 3 years. We won three straight divisions. It can be done. You just have to draft astutely and very smartly and keep your poise, keep your principles, and trust your scouts.
You know, part of the discussion, you know, with all this business going on with the Giants, you know, I've heard this age-old argument, is Eli an elite quarterback? So I get into the discussion. Well, I don't know what elite is or very good is. And I've never been a general manager, and I don't think anybody's going to ask me to be one anytime soon. But to me, if any GM, you tell me if I'm wrong, or right or wrong, if any GM is drafting a quarterback or he's sitting with his group drafting a quarterback, to me, the number one question is, can he take us to the Super Bowl? Can he make the delivery when it's all on the line? You know, obviously Eli has done that. But is that kind of a mindset when you're drafting a quarterback? Is that what you were thinking when you drafted, when you acquired Eli?
The only criteria I've ever had, now I came into the league with Johnny Unitas. I'm not interested in aesthetics. It's not figure skating, okay? And the fact is that the only criteria I ever used is can he win the championship? When we got the ball on the 17-yard line in the first Super Bowl, and I turned to my son, who was a coach at Virginia and Maryland, I said, if he is what we thought he was, he does it right now, not October 15th against, you know, Miami, okay, now. And that's all that matters. He won two Super Bowls. Marino won none. Favre won one. Rodgers has won one. Elway won two. John Brody, Y.A. Tittle won none. And look, if I walk into that office, Russ, and Eli had won 12 straight passing championships, and there are no trophies in there, then I got the wrong quarterback.
Hmm.
And he's there, and I'm not saying he did it alone, but I will tell you it's the single most important position in sports, that you can list the last 60 world champions going back before the Super Bowls and write down the names of the quarterbacks. And with the exception of about four, Billy Wade, the guy who beat us in Baltimore, Ripien, with the exception of about four or five, they're all in the Hall of Fame or near in the Hall of Fame. If they're not in the Hall of Fame, they're people who probably are going to get in the Hall of Fame, like Phil Simms.
Right.
And so without the quarterback, you're not going to win consistently. I mean, Baltimore waived that guy after he beat us. So if you're going to win consistently, you're going to have a great quarterback who's a winner. And I always remember as a kid, you know, I was a Colt fan, and we'd play against the 49ers, and Brody was an all-pro. I think we beat him 13 straight times. When Bobby Lane had the ball with 2 minutes to go, I had a pain in my stomach. And he was not pretty to watch, but he won three championships. And that's the criteria I always use. Now, everybody else may be different. Marino's had a phenomenal career, but he didn't even come close. He went to one Super Bowl, and they didn't, you know, they got beat badly. So was he a great quarterback? Yeah, he's one of the five or six greatest of all time. But the objective when you draft a quarterback is, can he win a championship? That's why, going back to the statement I made at the beginning of this podcast, that after the 2000 Super Bowl,
yeah,
I thought we had to get better.
Yeah, no, I that was, you know, pretty telling, you know, the way you put it that way. Let me ask you this, getting off quarterbacks. I'm in that Giants locker room every day, and I will tell you, they got a terrific group of guys. Very, very, very good. Now, you know, obviously they're not getting it done on the field, and that always becomes the bottom line. But as a GM and a coach as well, Ernie, and I'm looking at some of the names, guys that you signed, for example, as a free agent, you know, one jumps out at me, Antonio Pierce, who was a good guy. But I also called him a badass. You know, he was a tough guy. And he can shake things up within the locker room and get everybody's attention. You know, as a GM and a coach, do you look for, quote unquote, a badass with a little bit of, you know, as they say, piss and vinegar to his personality?
I look for a guy who's a competitor who can play in the clutch. I thought Jerry West was one of the greatest general managers in sports history. I mean, you study, now I know basketball, if you get Jabbar, you're over halfway home. I know all that. But I asked him once, whenever I have a chance when I was around Red Auerbach or any of those guys, I only asked one question because I don't want to bother them with 15 questions. And I said, what is the first thing you look for when you scout? Now, I've heard basketball people tell me, they're at a game in Wyoming. Jerry West was there scouting. I said, what is what you look for? I expected them to say hands, quick, good foot quickness. He said, my first question is this. Will he be a good teammate? Is he a good teammate? That takes in a lot of territory because you don't fool players. Players know, and I don't care what they say in the papers. I'm talking about what are they thinking, and you better know what's going on and what makes them tick, or you're not going to know your team. And players know who the guy is they can depend on when the chips are down. That's what you want. And you knew that Antonio Pierce you could depend on, or Tuck, or Osi, or Strahan. You could depend on those guys. Plexico. A lot of people criticize Plexico. When the chips were down, he supposedly, and I wasn't in the huddle, he beat, in the last regular season game in 2007, he was beating the defensive back with posts. And so he told Eli during the game, I could get open on a post corner because they're cheating on the post because of what happened in the last regular season game. And Eli said, save it till we need it. And what happens? The game-winning touchdown.
Yeah.
Championship-winning touchdown. That, to me, that's a smart, tough competitor who wants the ball when the chips are down. And that's what I look for. A badass isn't a term I'd use. Toughness.
Okay.
And who could come through in the clutch. That's what I want as a clutch athlete.
Well, I mean, listen, the guy you drafted, the guy we've been talking a bit about, Eli, might have the Opie Taylor from Mayberry personality, on the outside, but people forget how tough he is and how tough he's been.
The players knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they'll tell you that. And they know that. And tough. I've seen quarterbacks who, Bart Starr wasn't a big vociferous guy. But when Bart Starr walked over that sideline in the ice ball and it's Lombardi was going to call, hand off to the fullback, who was Chuck Brassine, because Corning and Taylor were gone. And he said, let me keep it. Now, everything's on the line. It's the last play of the game. You can't even feel the ball. No gloves. Let me keep it. And he knew he's running against Jethro Pugh and Bob Lilly. It's not like you and I were the two tackles. Okay?
Yeah, as I'm sitting here, and I think we'll get close to wrap this up, Ernie, but as I'm sitting here, talking about Eli, what's a good example of a guy not getting the proper protection for his entire career? Because I do believe had he gotten the proper protection, he'd be a Hall of Famer. Was Eli's dad, Archie.
Oh, my God.
I mean, Archie, to me, is one of the greatest, without a doubt, one of the greatest college quarterbacks I have ever seen. In fact, I don't think Peyton or Eli in college was as good as him. But, listen, he played on a team, on a Saints team, that he got his bell rung and his chin knocked in almost every game, and subsequently he's not a Hall of Famer.
And he played quarterback, ran more. In college, he was a running quarterback,
right.
and they didn't throw much in the South. They didn't throw in the Southeastern Conference. I mean, Vince Dooley told me, he said, Steve Spurrier taught our league how to throw, how to pass.
Mm-hmm.
We were a running conference before that. And, he'd roll out a lot and run the ball a lot. But the beating he took in New Orleans is he never got a chance. You talk about the way they drafted. I mean, they gave us Burt Jones. Now, this was at the end of Archie's career. They gave us Burt Jones in Baltimore for a defensive end who couldn't rush the passer, straight up. And no swap, no nothing, straight up. And there's a guy who would have gone to the Hall of Fame if he wouldn't have gotten hurt. But Archie had to play with that his entire career and never made a peep, never said a word. I mean, I ran the Pro Bowl three times when I worked for the commissioner. And I had the NFC team, and we never could get him in the Pro Bowl because he was always hurt. Three times I tried to, he was elected to the Pro Bowl, and we had to get somebody else because he was always hurt. He was always undergoing surgery at the end of the year.
Well, I obviously, I'm sure that had something to do with his mindset many years later, wanting Eli to end up with you guys and not with the you know, San Diego Chargers. But
right.
That was then, and this is now. Now it's 1-7, and hopefully the next time we chat, my friend, it'll be a lot better than 1-7. Ernie Accorsi, what can I say? It's always a pleasure. It's an honor having you on, and it's a bigger honor calling you a friend. So I thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Russ. Always enjoyable with you.
All right, my friend. We'll talk soon. Thank you. Ernie Accorsi, special guy. They don't make them like him. Anyway, folks, that's a wrap on today. I want to thank you all for getting a load of this. Now I'd like to get a load of you. Let me know your thoughts on today's conversation with Ernie Accorsi. You can let me know at Twitter, at Russ Salzberg, on Facebook. You can also go to my website, check it out. Real simple, it's russsalzberg.com. You can check out my blogs there. My thanks to the big guy across the way here, taking care of the board, Crash, a.k.a. Mike Caragliano. My thanks to Tim Einenkel, a producer for the OG Podcast Network. My thanks to 77 WABC Program Director Craig Schwab, to his assistant program director Matt Dahl, and always my thanks to yous people out there, because without yous people, I'd have nobody here to be talking to. So until next time, it's Russ Salzberg saying bye-bye, so long, and farewell.